Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane while she's away on vacation. The Credit Card Act changed the way those under 21 can get charge cards. The idea is to keep young people from being saddled with credit card debt by the time they graduate and head to the workforce. Joining us in the studio is Edmund Mierzwinski of the U.S. PIRG Consumer Program, joining us from NPR's New York Bureau, Adam Levin of Credit.com. And Karen Blumenthal of The Wall Street Journal, who writes about this issue regularly, joins us from a Cake Mix recording studio in Dallas, Texas. Welcome to you all. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us all.
You can join our conversation, every one of you, at 1-800-433-8850. drshow@wamu.org, as always, is our email address. And Karen, you've been writing a lot about this new law, which went into effect earlier this year. Give our listeners a quick summary of the main points.
Well, basically, if you're under 21, you can't get a credit card unless you can show that you have income or unless a parent co-signs with you. So this changes a lot of things. A lot of freshmen would come to school ready to get a credit card on campus, and they could easily get one, ironically, you know, even though they may not have any income. But now it's going to be a lot tougher unless your parents agree to help you with it.
And so in the weeks ahead, as students go off to college, we're used to these scenes of credit card companies setting up tables and offering free pizza and T-shirts to sign up for credit cards with virtually no limit. You expect this scene to change?
Well, actually, that's not allowed anymore. There's real restrictions on how credit card companies can market. Although, as a parent of a college-age student, I can tell you we've been getting some mail.
Well, tell
so
me what
finding ways
interesting.
What
has the mail been saying?
Oh, no, she's getting credit card offers that say, you know, even though we know you're in school, here's an opportunity. So it's been kind of interesting to see in my own household.
But in order to, if she's under 21, you would still have to co-sign.
Well, that's true, unless they can show income. And interestingly, they because credit cards for students don't have very high credit limits, they don't have to show very much income. One bank told me as little as $3,000 a year would qualify you for a credit card with a small credit limit.
Edmund Mierzwinski, what's your sense of the impact of this law?
Well, I think, Steve, that it's a very important law, and it has many other provisions that affect all of us. But the college credit card provisions, which U.S. PIRG and other student-based groups promoted, are very important. As Karen said, college students and other young people, it's something that they were treated differently than everybody else before. They could get a credit card without having a good credit report or without having a co-signer. Nobody else could. Now college students will be treated the same. I think fewer of them will get in trouble. They will no longer, the credit card companies, be able to force you to fill out an application to get a free gift. They actually still can give out free gifts, but they can't condition the gift on the basis of you filling out an application. We would have preferred no gifts at all. And third, some of the colleges, most of the big ones, have relationships with credit card companies for affinity cards. And those cards, they make a lot of money on alumni use of the card. None of us have any problem with that. But the credit card companies insidiously really wanted information about undergrads. So you have these 100-page contracts, which are now public, between the colleges and the credit card companies. You can request one from a college or a credit card company. That 99 of the pages, I'm only exaggerating a little, were about making sure that regular updated lists of how to contact the students were provided to the credit card company. So a lot of changes in the way things are going. I think it's a very positive development.
Adam, what is the, in your mind, the significance of this new law? And what was the problem aimed at that this law aimed to correct?
Well, I think either the law in general or the law relative
particularly
to
relating
students.
To students, yeah.
Well, I think it was in the old days, if you could fog a mirror and you were a student, you got a credit card.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, students got saddled with astronomical amounts of debt relative to where they were economically by the time they graduated college. And if you add that to the burden that they face paying off student loans, I mean, it was crushing. And we're supposed to put our young people in a position where when they graduate college, they're beginning to build a new life as opposed to dig out of a hole.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this law is very important that way. And I think also, hopefully, the way it's structured, that students will, as they go through college and leave college, begin to look at credit not as crime and punishment, but rather as a wealth builder, as an enabler, and as a tool for creating greater financial security. So I think it's an important step. Congress was dead right, and I think all the public interest groups that supported it have won a big victory, as has the public.
But Karen, you've been writing in the Wall Street Journal that there are potential unintended consequences here of this law, as there almost always is from any law, even
right.
the best law. What should we be watching out for on that score?
Well, as a parent, I actually have some real concerns because I wanted my kids to have the experience of learning how to manage credit. And in order to do that, then they have to have room to make their own mistakes. So if I have to co-sign, then that, as a parent, makes me have to helicopter in if they're going to make a mistake. I encourage my kids to get credit cards after their freshman year and to learn how to use them because it's very important today for a young person to build a credit record. And you need a couple of years of credit by the time you graduate so that you can get, if you need it, a car loan, you can rent an apartment. It may even affect your employment. So knowing that, I literally pushed my 19-year-old last summer to get a credit card before this law went into effect. And because I want my adult children to be adults and make adult decisions. I'll give you one story that one of my children missed a payment and had to pay late and then had to pay a late fee. If I had to co-sign, I would have wanted to jump in so that wouldn't affect my credit. But I was actually thrilled because I'll tell you, after that child paid that late fee, she will never pay another late fee. It was a great lesson.
Well, and to clarify, your point is that if you're a co-signer, your own credit record and history is in jeopardy if your child overspends. And so if you're a co-signer, when you say you have that motive to be a helicopter parent, not necessarily a good
right.
thing. But the reason is that your own credit history is at stake.
That's right. When you're a co-signer, that credit appears on your record as though it were yours as well as theirs. And you can't get off of a credit card like you can a bank account where you can call the bank and have your name taken off. In order to get off of a co-signed credit card, you have to close that account, and the child, after he or she is 21, has to open a new account. And that has some slight credit record implications, too. So those are some of the unintended consequences, I think, for those of us who want our kids to learn how to manage money properly and to make their mistakes early when they're small and they're still pretty young.
Now, Edmund,
in for a second. It's Adam. What about the possibility, though, of adding a child as an additional cardholder? I mean, they would get the benefit of developing credit with your history. It would put them in a position where they might be more restrained in the way they spend because mm-hmm. they know you're going to take a look at the bill, and if they screw up, at least you're going to be looking over their shoulder. Of course, there's the other alternative. If we want our children to be more adult, we could say, hey, get a job. If you get a job,
right.
even a part-time job, you have an opportunity then to get in the game with credit cards.
Adam, I want to clarify what you're suggesting, which is that if you put a child as a authorize them to have their own card, but on your account, is that what you're describing?
Yes. Yeah. So to me, it's a several stage step as I deal with little ones myself. And that is that, you know, first put them on as an additional card holder. They know I'll be watching. Mm-hmm. So as a result, they might be a bit more controlled. Reminds me of a time when a friend of mine said to his child, hey, I'm going to give you a credit card for emergencies, but keep one thing in mind. If you can burn it, wear it, drink it, or eat it, it's not an emergency. The second step would be, after they've proved for a year that they can be somewhat responsible, then you say, okay, I'm willing to take the shot and co-sign. Remember, if they're an additional cardholder, you make one call, they're off the card. If they're a co-signer, yes, it's kind of like till death do us part. But in addition to which, say, get a job. But it's very important for parents and their kids to together talk about the credit system, how to operate mm-hmm. effectively in the credit system, because I think the one thing that all of the regulatory reform and the credit card reform acts are pointing to is the fact that in addition to making institutions more accountable to us, we have to make us accountable to ourselves.
Sure, and I want to get to that point in just a minute, but I want to ask Ed one more point here. As a college teacher myself, I see a lot of my students set up, in effect, debit accounts at the university, and they have a card where they simply draw down the balance that they or their parents put in. I have one myself. That sounds to me like also a sensible alternative, a debit system where you can't run up big bills beyond the amount that has been put in.
I think you're exactly right. And in fact, the banks have seized on the new opportunity of forming relationships with colleges to issue student ID / debit cards, prepaid cards that can be reloaded. I have other issues that apply to all debit cards. I believe they are risky in the sense that if they're linked to your actual bank account, like an ATM card, if you're a victim of fraud, you can lose all your money and it's hard to get it back. But the prepaid reloadable cards seem like a good alternative. The banks are making a lot of money on this on the college campuses. So it is an alternative. The other alternative, of course, is that the students who do have an income or some money in the bank do still qualify for credit cards, and they should get them. They have to be sensible with them because, again, if you wreck your credit when you're in college, you can't get a car rental when you're getting that first
and
job.
And that's part of what kids don't really understand.
That's what they
don't get. It's not just getting their parents mad at them. It's being able to rent an apartment or buy a card, and this whole question of the impact on your credit history, it stays with you. It doesn't end.
Exactly.
That's Ed Mirzwinski of the U.S. PIRG. Adam Levin of Credit.com is with me, as well as Karen Blumenthal, who writes on these issues for The Wall Street Journal, who's on the phone in Texas. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane today. We're going to be back with your calls and your comments on this question of credit, particularly credit cards for college students as the school year opens. So stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane today. Our subject this hour, with the advent of the new school year on college campuses, credit cards. There's a new credit card act that is in effect that started in February. This is the first beginning of school that will be under this new act. And I have three experts with me, Edmund Mirzwinski of the U.S. PIRG, Karen Blumenthal, Wall Street Journal, and Adam Levin of Credit.com. Karen, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to jump in on a couple of those points that we were just discussing. On the issue of providing a card of your, adding your child as a signer on one of your cards, I agree with Adam that that's a good way to start, but the child doesn't pay the bill. And so it's very important for them to develop the discipline of bill paying. That's the number one factor in your credit score is paying on time, and that seems really obvious, but it's important to learn how to do it. And the other, on these issues of these debit cards with the colleges, I have real mixed feelings about these. They are very convenient because kids can go off campus and use their school card at restaurants and laundromats and all kinds of places. But as a parent, I've been almost attacked on the quad at freshman orientation, encouraging me to connect my credit card or my debit card so that I become a human breathing ATM for my child. They don't learn to budget that way. So we insisted that our kids, get a certain amount each month and that they feed their own debit cards and decide what they want to do. But it's very tricky. That student card is for laundry. If you feel strongly about laundry, then your child has to have money on that card. But they also need, you know, money in other places. So it becomes a significant money management issue between the parents and the kids.
Well, doesn't this a lot of this come down? We've been talking a lot about the rules about credit cards. But a lot of this comes down to habits. It comes down to discipline. It comes down to how people use these cards. And part of what you've been implying, Karen, is that a lot of this is the training and the discipline kids absorb from their parents and from other sources before they get a step on that college campus.
Right. And it becomes the burden is on the parents to teach them a lot because, as I think we're seeing, there's a lot of pressure on the parents to just keep, you know, feeding the meter, to, you know, to add to their student card, to provide other money or to co-sign the credit card and protect them that way. So then it becomes the parents' burden to make sure that the children are taking responsibility and, you know, becoming responsible adults.
But if I might just jump in and add this, and that is that when we're talking about the concept of discipline, and certainly, you know, parents and and disciplining their children seem to be sort of, you know, that which we all grew up with. The fact is that if we are initially, as they become an additional cardholder on our card, they don't pay the bill, that's not necessarily has to be the case. We could say, look, you will pay your portion of this bill. I've allotted money or whatever, you know, the normal practice is, and it's real simple. Let's pretend for the moment I, your parent, I'm the bank. You don't pay the bill within a certain period of time. I'm not going to charge you late fee. I'm just going to make one phone call, and you're off the cart.
But well, let me
add. So that may be a, you know.
I understand that point, and it's an interesting one, but I'm trying to get to the step before that. As kids are growing up, do any of you have thoughts on how you can inculcate a sense of responsibility about money, a sense of obligation to be careful and considerate with money? Several of you mentioned if a kid has a job and makes her own money, this is a good step as well. Ed, what are some of your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that's exactly right. And I'll just throw out another issue here that is an issue with if you have a debit card or if you have an authorized user on your own credit card or even a co-signer, the student or the young person is learning about debt and credit and learning about budgeting, depending on how well the parent functions as the bank or depending on how well the other tricks and traps work out. But what they're not building up in most of those cases, in fact, all of those cases, is a credit score. That's the one good thing about having a card in your name, if you do qualify, is that using the card in your name builds up points in the credit reporting system over time. Of course, doing a bad job, you lose points, but that's another thing to think about.
But I always thought that a kid who earns her own money almost automatically learns a certain lesson about value that is irreplaceable. Karen, what do you think about that?
No, that's absolutely true. And there's research that shows that kids who earn their own money are much more sensitive about spending it. They understand more about where it comes from. But I'm also sensitive to the fact that kids who are real involved in sports or debate or some of these other activities that I think have a great value don't have a lot of extra time. And so it's a mixed bag. It can be difficult even in the summers for some of these kids who may spend their whole summers, you know, in soccer camps or whatever to do that.
I forget, Karen, whether it was in one of your columns, one of the most simple ideas that really struck me as useful to teach even very young children the value of money is to put a jar at the door, have kids contribute change, and they can have a tangible sense of money growing when they see it in the jar. I remember this wonderful story I read to my grandchildren called "A Chair for My Mother," which has this, right at the core of the story, where the mother and the kids save for a chair because their house had burned down. And I've always thought, what a wonderful lesson about the value of money. Is this something that you would recommend parents do?
Yeah, absolutely. Some parents want to do an allowance and they have three jars, and they have a jar for short term and a jar for long term, so they learn the value of saving for something. And sometimes there's a jar for charity or for another, you know, something else, maybe very long term. And those are good skills, too. I do happen to believe that a child's money should be his or her own and for them to decide how to spend, because, again, those spending mistakes are going to be their best lessons.
And one final point on this, Adam. It also strikes me that some of the advice that makes sense is to include kids at a fairly young age in spending decisions, say going to a grocery store and pointing out comparison shopping, this one at 2-for-1 is a better value, or the use of coupons. Or even now in the age of online, it makes it much easier to point out to kids the comparison shopping in terms of these sneakers costing compared to other sneakers. It seems to me that there are ways in which you can educate kids pretty young on the value of money.
No, I think so. And I think that we underestimate the sponge-like ability of young people to learn things that they don't have the fear that older people do. They don't have the, I don't think I can understand that, that many older people do. So I think it's so important to start people at a young age. But this highlights a problem we have in this country in general, and that is for a nation that is presumably literate as we are, I think what we've seen over the past few years is that we are shockingly financially illiterate. And that there has not been enough focus on financial education in this country. And a lot of people say, well, you know, my parents should have done a better job. And the answer is, well, nobody taught them.
Yeah.
So it's you know, it's really been like trial and error. So I think that, you know, this is part of hopefully what these laws will achieve also is to step up financial literacy. My mother always used to say, all money is round. You can lose it faster than you made it. I grew up in a world where I was post-depression, so I didn't necessarily in my heart of hearts believe that. After the past few years, I think families in general and young people as well have seen the horror that can occur. And I think that that hopefully that is a lesson we'll carry forward.
I want to get to some of our callers and emailers here who are contributing their own experiences. And let's start with Tim in Kill Devil Hills in North Carolina, over on the Outer Banks. I graduated with 5 credit cards and $15,000 in debt. I guess the figure now, the average figure, is about $4,000 in debt. I don't believe a law would have taught me how to manage my credit. It is the parents' responsibility to teach their kids. I learned the hard way and will teach my kids the correct way to manage their credit. I don't trust the government to raise my kids for me. Why does the government feel like they need to raise our kids? People need to accept the consequences and live and learn. Ed?
Well, by the way, for college students, USPIRG has a website, truthaboutcredit.org, where we have tips on how to use credit cards on campus.
Good.
And the results of our surveys. But I don't think the government is stepping in here and telling people what to do. I think the government is regulating some of the unfair practices of the credit card companies, who are a menace to everyone. And they're simply providing a roadmap for a better life and future for people. And there are a lot of people in trouble in college who are emancipated young people. They don't have parents, unfortunately, who might have taught them these values. And there's just a lot of problems in college with rising tuition. Credit cards are an easy out. We need to teach people about that.
Well, you're making an important point, because we're having this discussion in a larger economic climate where tuitions are going up. Families are often struggling. I see this at George Washington University. A number of my students, almost overnight, parents losing jobs and being faced with tremendous financial pressures, and student loans burdens often going up. So this question of financial literacy and taking responsibility is happening in a larger economic context that in many ways puts more pressure on young people than ever.
I think you're exactly right. And it is a massive public policy question. There are a lot of thoughtful people thinking and writing about this. Anya Kamenetz has a book, Generation Debt. Tamara Drought of Demos has a book, Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. They're graduating from college, or they're just entering the workforce, whether or not they went to college, in this perfect storm of a bad economy and fewer jobs. They've got to be careful with the credit cards.
I think if I just may add one thing, and that is that this brings to light also another issue, and that is, the communication you just got talked about with the government and that. And that is that one thing consumers have to keep in mind, and I think, Ed and Karen, with what we've all done together and separately and what we do, is the fact is that it doesn't matter how many laws there are, and it doesn't even matter how vigorously those laws are enforced. The ultimate guardian of the consumer is the consumer. And nobody has a greater stake in the financial security of any individual than we do, and no one has a greater familiarity with the transactions we do and what we get ourselves into better than we do.
Right. Let me read this next email. I am unable to get a credit card, writes one listener. I'm 30, no dollars in debt, and I'm in the middle class with a stable income. I've never applied for any credit until a few months ago after the new credit laws went into effect. I even checked my credit history, and it's non-existent. Wow. I've been denied by several credit companies for insufficient credit score. How does one get credit without being approved for credit? And how come college kids without much income at all are getting approved? This was a point several of you have made about the unintended consequences, Karen.
Right. This is the credit score problem. If you don't have credit, then you don't have a credit score. For that listener, there are two ways to do it. One is to apply for retail credit, which sometimes is easier to get, and the other is to start with a secured card where you put $500 in the bank and then you get a secured credit card with a limit of $500, and after a year or so you can convert it to a regular credit card. But this is why I think our college students ought to have some credit experience. This is exactly the problem. Isn't it ironic? Even things like car insurance, to get the best rates, they're looking for you to have not one account but two or three in order to prove that you know how to pay bills. So this is, unfortunately, and we can argue a lot about whether that's a good system, but it's the game that we're playing right now.
That's a very important point. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's turn to some of our other callers who are anxious to join us. Nat in Frisco, Texas. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hey, thank you. Good show.
Thanks.
But it is funny to hear such comments that you guys are making, because this is I'm kind of laughing along the process, you know. And I have a quick question to your guest there, Karen. I think taking responsibilities of your own kid, doesn't matter whether they're 50 years old or 40 years old or 30 years old or 20 years old, is the first and foremost thing you should be doing. I think we forgot the simple fact is this, that we do not take responsibilities of our own kids, meaning at the age of 18, 20, 25, 23, we just want them to go get a credit card, you know, go get out of the house, you know, go do this. But, you know, I grew up in a different type of family where I stayed in my house till I was fully sufficient, you know, on my earnings and everything. My parents paid for my college education, you know, and they taught me one thing is this. You save your money, you buy your car cash, you buy your house with cash. And if you have, if you don't have a cash, that means that this is not your money. Okay, we simply forgot that simple thing to teach our kids, or should just take the responsibility as a father and mother. You know, you're my kid. You're 25 years old. You're still not responsible. Here, I'm going to teach you responsible. You're going to stay in my house till you save enough money to get yourself your own car.
Thank you so much, Nat. That's an interesting point of view. Adam, what do you say to someone like Nat who says, you know, the way I was raised is don't use credit at all. Pay cash.
Well, you know, again, I don't disagree with the concept that if you can't afford it, don't buy it. But the problem is, as we talked about earlier today, since credit pervades every aspect of our lives, unless you're going to live in a log cabin on Loon Lake and say that I'm not going to be part of the economic system, we are part of an economic system, and it's a situation where in order to thrive, for young people to thrive and get part of the American dream, we have to learn how to operate in that system. We have to build credit. We have to build a credit portfolio, and parents should be encouraging kids, don't buy what you can't pay for, but remember that this is the best investment you can make, is to invest in your understanding of and operation within the credit system.
Let's turn to Margarita in Rockville, Maryland. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, first-time caller. Thank you so much for bringing up this super important topic. I'm 23 and in grad school, and I run the gambit of, I think, any mistake that any kid could make about credit. And I just have a very brief question for you guys. Luckily, my parents were able to help me dig out of the hole, and I'm very very aware that not everyone has such, you know, amazing parents. What I want to know is, are there any sort of education systems in place other than parents to educate college kids, not necessarily about managing money, but about, you know, what is an interest rate? What does it mean to build your credit? What's good credit and what's bad credit? And I wish I had listened to my bursar's office a little more when I went into undergraduate, because I feel like these are paramount lessons that are just required for adulthood. They should be a, you know, credit 101 in freshman year.
Thank you, Margarita. Briefly, Ed, before we take
a break. Well, briefly, I think she's exactly right. There are all kinds of programs out there, but they're sporadic. They're not necessarily required by law. They're not audited. But we need more.
Some high schools have them.
High schools have them. Some colleges do.
Some colleges.
Would you like to see more of them?
We'd like to see more. And the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau will have a responsibility for financial literacy, by the way.
Interesting point. That's Ed Mierzwinski of PIRG, U.S. PIRG, Karen Blumenthal, The Wall Street Journal, and Adam Levin of Credit.com also with me. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. We're going to come back with more of your calls, so stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, what should medicine do when it can't save your life?
At the end, the way we care for people probably worsens their life and shortens their life.
Physician and journalist Atul Gawande talks about his article in The Current New Yorker. Also, Steve Carell and Jay Roach tell us about making their movie Dinner for Schmucks. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. And the subject this hour, credit cards, and particularly credit cards for young people entering college, entering the workforce as the fall college semester starts. And we have three experts. Edmund Mierzwinski of the U.S. PIRG is with me here in the studio. Adam Levin of Credit.com is on the phone from New York. And Karen Blumenthal from The Wall Street Journal is in Dallas, Texas. And I've got a bunch of emails here, and I'd like some quick answers because they asked some specific questions. Ron in Grand Rapids. It was briefly mentioned, but with the economic crisis, more and more potential employers are reviewing credit reports. And I'm sure credit reports will be used in more and more situations to determine responsibility. And I guess what Ron is also implying, employability.
Well, Steve, that's a very good question. And the Congress has been looking at it for years. Legislation by Representative Cohen and Gutierrez would ban the use of credit reports for employment purposes. Most civil rights and consumer groups and many experts don't think there's a relationship. If you're going to be a bank teller, maybe. But if you're going to be a journalist or a consumer advocate, why does our employer need to look at our credit report? It's a big problem.
Plus, there's an additional issue, and the issue is that a lot of people have taken enormous hits on their credit reports because they have become unemployed because of the economy. So, therefore, it is no indication of their responsibility as a borrower. It is an indication of the fact that they have been torpedoed by the economy.
That's exactly right. And one quick thing. Even FICO, the credit score company, is saying that in this bad economy, credit scores may not be as good a measure of anything as they used to be.
One of the things that Ed and I were talking about briefly off the air was in this economic mix, and I know, Karen, you've written about this. On top of all the other problems these young grads are facing, or not just graduates, but young people going to the workforce, is that even if they get a job, it often doesn't come with health benefits, and that one of the added burdens on parents and kids is paying for health benefits.
Right. The new health care law allows you to keep your children on your health care plan if you're at a corporate plan until they're 26. And I happen to think this is wonderful because I think one of the greatest fears for parents is to not have health insurance for your kids. But it does mean that a parent foots the bill now a lot longer than they might have otherwise.
Grace from Dallas writes, I've been out of college for 2 years. I have a few concerns about this bill. This bill appears to favor students who have creditworthy parents to fall back upon and who are able to support them as a result. It seems to enforce the socioeconomic status of students entering college. Your reaction, Adam?
My reaction, again, is that the alternative is that a young person has an opportunity to get a job, and I think they should get a job. I don't view this bill in any way as class warfare.
Okay. John writes to us, why would closing or canceling a credit card without prejudice result in negative credit points?
Oh, I can. The reason is because it impacts your available credit, which impacts the percentage of credit that you use, that your credit utilization, which is a critical component of your credit score. And it also could impact the age of your credit history. If it's a longstanding card, if you cancel it, it could lower the age. Though the utilization percentage is the one that's most important.
Related question from Joe Ellen. If you apply for a credit card and are turned down, does that negatively affect your credit score?
Has a small impact, maybe even a bigger impact for some people, but it's best to keep your old cards and keep your balances low. That's what they mean by utilization.
You know, one of the things I'm hearing here is almost a tyranny of this credit score. I mean, I must say I'm surprised at how often your answers are coming back to how important that question is.
I've written a lot about this, and I can't tell you the email I get whenever I write on this subject. Partly because it's very mysterious, and we've only really had access to that information, even our credit records, for a fairly short period of time. But the other thing is we are fully responsible for making sure that our credit reports are correct. So it's your job, and really, who really thinks about doing this, to go to the credit bureaus once a year or to go to each credit bureau every 4 months and make sure that the information's correct. That's kind of an additional burden that people don't think about. And then on top of that, you need to think about, you know, what are the factors? Am I paying on time? Am I using too much of my credit? It becomes very complicated, and it's quite a black box for a lot of consumers.
On the score front, there is one slight piece of good news, and that is the Udall Amendment to the Overhaul Act, which says that in the event that you receive an adverse action, which means you're turned down for a loan or for a particular service, or you receive an unfavorable rate, which means a rate that's unfavorable relative to people that have good credit, you're entitled to see the score that led to or contributed mm-hmm. to that decision. Now, that's fairly good news because what it means is that you get to see your credit score, but only after something relatively horrible has happened to you. So it's kind of like winning an Emmy, having your show canceled. I think we all would believe that the best would be that anytime any score is pulled on you in connection with any decision, that you are entitled to see that score because, frankly, right. It's already been paid for.
Right. Let's turn to Jessica in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Jessica, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering if this new law takes into account financial aid procedures at universities. In 2003, I was a new university student, and I was on financial aid. And at least at that point in time, my university financial aid refunds were not processed until the week after classes started. So we didn't actually get our money for books and things like that until after classes had already started. And I had work study jobs, but of course the paycheck didn't come for a month afterwards, and my parents weren't in a position to help me. And I remember the first time I found myself in this situation, I needed to buy my books, and it was the first day of classes, and I didn't have my financial aid refund. So I actually called the university, and I called the financial aid office, and then was transferred to the business office. And I was hoping that maybe there was some kind of program, like an advance that I could get or something like that. And I was told by the staff person at the university, literally told, no, what you need to do is go down to the bookstore and fill out a credit card application. They have lots of them, and that's how you need to buy your books. And then you can pay it back after the fact. And when I protested, I had a credit card, but I didn't like the answer that I got. I thought that was inappropriate. She said, well, that's what works for all the other students, and we give you guys credit card applications in the bags, in your textbook bags, after you buy your textbooks for that reason. And I was just really shocked by that, that there was a university staff person telling me I needed to go apply for a credit card as a first-year university student to pay for my books.
Okay. Let's get Karen, who's an expert on this. Let's get her reaction. Thanks for the call, Jessica.
Well, you know, I'm afraid that wasn't uncommon. It may be less common now that things are so much tighter, but financial aid is not a factor in that credit card application. In fact, income is self-reported, so nobody actually goes and officially checks. And that's all that they look at is that, and or whether you're at that time, whether you were a student, and even today, if you're over 21. That's what they would look at. You know, that's a money management issue. That's, again, we talk about student debt, tuition. You know, you forget that books run about $1,200 a year. It's another huge expense.
Let's talk to Scott in Watertown, New York. Scott, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show. Scott?
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Yes, please. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Hey, we just paid $20,000 off in credit card debt over the last year and a half. And I have to say, we'll never use credit cards again and hopefully not borrow money again, except for maybe a house. But I'll tell you what happens. When you stop paying other people money, what happens to your savings account? It just goes up high. And now all of a sudden, when you have a savings account, you don't have emergencies anymore. You can pay cash. In fact, it only took me like 3 months to save up $5,000 to buy a used pickup truck, and I did not need a credit score to go buy cash for a used car. And it's just amazing. And then the second part about debit, I think that for young kids, I will teach my kids this, the debit card, replenishing a debit card for them to use, and as far as the fraud, the riskiness of it, our bank, we had about $800 or $900 stolen a couple of years ago out of a debit card account. And the bank replaced it the next day without question. So it's not that risky. It's no more riskier than using a credit card. If it's fraudulent, you are not liable for that money. So I appreciate the thing. I think people just need to wait and pay cash for things. That is simply what credit cards are for. It's people's inability to wait to pay for things until they have the cash.
Okay, Scott, thanks very much. This is the second comment, Adam, we've had about cash.
Well, no, again, I think it's important to not buy things you can't afford and to, you know, responsibly approach purchases. But I think you also need to build a solid credit history and have it available in the event that you have an emergency or you have an opportunity to do something and you have a plan in order to responsibly use it. And just as a side note on the debit card, it's great that that bank replaced the money the next day. Not all banks do that. And let's say they even do, they don't necessarily do it the next day. And in the 10 days or so it takes them to replace it, if that was money you needed for groceries or rent, you could have an issue.
And you had something to say on this
just
point.
I agree with Adam on the fraud on debit cards, but I agree with the caller on the importance of having savings. Many studies have shown that if people have just a small cushion of emergency money, even $2,000, even $500, they won't get into such credit card traps or payday lending traps when they have a problem. Asset building is a major policy goal.
Let's turn to Brian in Columbia, Missouri. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Happy to have you. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to address earlier, Karen had mentioned that, you know, it's important to get, you know, for people to get their kids a credit card. It teaches them the responsibility. And one thing I would just like to point out is that, you know, when I was younger, I got a credit card. And, you know, my folks said, make sure you make the payments and all this. And, yeah, sure, getting a late fee is a terrible thing. But the one thing no one ever explained to me was the fact that, you know, you make that minimum payment, and eventually the interest builds up, and you end up owing more money if you make that minimum payment. And, you know, so I just wanted to point out, and didn't mention that, because, you know, I felt self-empowered by making my minimum payment. And then a year later, I suddenly realized, oh, my gosh. So I just think that's an important aspect that should be included. Maybe I missed that, but, you know, so not necessarily making your payments every month is going to help you in the long run. You might feel better about it and learn a lesson to pay on time, but you're going to end up owing in the long run. So,
Brian, thank you. Just one second. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Go ahead, Adam.
Okay, but I think that one of the important aspects, for instance, of the credit card reform legislation is the disclosure now of how long it would take you to actually pay off your credit card if you only made the minimum payment. And I know that Karen was saying that you make a payment, but I'm sure what she was saying, knowing Karen, is she was saying, but don't just make the minimum payment, make the payments. And knowing how long it takes you to pay off your credit card now, as opposed to a vision, oh, I'll pay it off in a timely fashion, and then you suddenly realize it's going to take you three decades to pay it off. So if someone, you know, wants to say the Credit Card Reform Act, is it government crawling into people's lives? It is causing more fairness and transparency in the system, and this kind of transparency will actually be a teaching tool and I think help people become more responsible.
Karen, quickly, what you want to add?
Yeah, this new chart is truly one of the things that stops a really insidious practice, and it's right at the top of your credit card bill. You know, there's still some other things they do, like sending blank checks, which I think is really outrageous. But this new chart is a big help in helping people understand what it means to make the minimum payment.
And part of what our caller was saying, and you've been saying too, that it can be very costly just to keep making minimum payments, that you're much better off handling it more expeditiously.
You pay the whole thing.
John in Washington, D.C., you're on the Diane Rehm Show. We're happy to have you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please go ahead.
Great show. My observation question, but it was too complicated to lay out in just several seconds, so let me just give you a quick anecdote. On last week, I opened an account for my son at our bank, mm-hmm. so that he has now a debit/credit card. He is 14 years old, entering ninth grade, and needs to become aware and appreciative of the things that he needs has to be paid for by what is in his account. I'm hoping that at that age, he's going to build a habit, which is the whole idea. It not to empower him to go buy things he can't afford. It's just to let him learn how to discipline will help him in the long run. And gosh, from your comments, I hope I've done the right thing, and I'll just go off the air. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, John. This point, Ed, of habits, I mean, a lot of this comes down to that, doesn't it? I mean, all of the legislation is helpful. The information on the credit card, the statement that Karen just mentioned is helpful. But in the end, it comes down to how people behave.
Building up the habits and ingraining people with the ideas of making the payments on time and making as big as you can, just like this parent is going to be along with his son doing these things, is a very important point.
We only have a minute left, and I want to give each of you a chance. We've got a lot of listeners out there. As I say, this is a month before classes begin. I bet there are a lot of folks who are going to be dealing with these issues in a very practical way. What advice, Karen, would you give to a parent like you, who's a parent of a college student or a young person entering the workforce, about how to deal with these issues?
I think you have to sit down with them and you have to go over the money issues. You have to discuss the budget and you have to discuss how things will be paid and who does what. It's the same thing you're going to do when you explain how to do the laundry. It's just one of those basic things that's part of sending them off. And I'll put in a plug that we're writing about this subject Saturday after this one.
In the Wall Street Journal.
In the Wall Street Journal.
Okay, good. What about you, Adam? What advice would you give?
Well, I think that just as parents have the big talk with their kids about drugs and sex before they go off to college or even before, you've got to have the big talk with your kids about credit and finances because, again, this really is one of the critical portfolios you have in life, And the earlier you build it and the more responsibly you build it, the better off your life will be.
And Ed, as our last caller said, his son was 14. Probably one of the takeaways here is start this conversation before they go to college at an earlier age.
College is too late, really. The programs need to be started much, much earlier with parents and schools.
Okay, that's going to have to be the last word. Ed Mierzwinski has been with me. He's from USPIRG, Consumer Program. Joining us from NPR's New York Bureau, Adam Levin of Credit.com, and Karen Blumenthal, who writes about these issues for The Wall Street Journal, has been with us from Dallas, Texas. Thanks so much for all of you and all of your calls and your comments. A lot of good listeners joining our conversation today. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and thanks for spending an hour of your morning with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.